Good afternoon. My name is Marcy, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Microsoft Professional Developer Conference Announcement Impact and Insights Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. You may begin your conference.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and thanks, everyone, for joining us. My name is Neil McDonald. I'm Vice President and Gartner Fellow. I'm the primary analyst for Microsoft or on Microsoft here at Gartner. And joining me today are a couple of Gartner analysts. First, we've got David Smith, a Vice President and Gartner Fellow, and one of our lead analysts on web computing and cloud computing platforms. And Michael Silver, joining us from our desktop computing group, where he's a vice president and distinguished analyst. He's going to talk about Windows 7 and the implications on Vista migrations. And I've asked Tom Bittman to join us as well, vice president and distinguished analyst and director of research on our infrastructure and operations side. I've asked Tom to join us during the section on the impact on the enterprise IT departments. So last week was Microsoft's Professional Developer Conference out in Los Angeles, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but the big announcements took place at the beginning of the week. And that's what we're here to talk about today, is the impact of these announcements on your organizations. So here's our rough agenda. First, we're going to talk about what was announced at the PDC. And equally as important, what wasn't announced? What didn't Microsoft talk about that we felt that they should have discussed and provided more detail on? Then I'm going to turn it over to David to talk about Gartner's view of cloud platforms and how Microsoft's offerings map into our framework and an analysis of their cloud services across the board. Then I'll look at the impact on enterprise IT for you all that are in IT departments or running IT departments. We'll look at the impact of Microsoft's announcement on your infrastructure. And then we'll have Mike Silver lead a discussion on Windows 7 and the impact on Vista migrations. We realize this is a very important issue for you, whether or not you should migrate to Windows Vista or consider skipping Vista now that Microsoft is distributing Windows 7 code, which they did last week at the PDC. And then finally, we'd like to leave 10 to 15 minutes for Q&A. We can either do that over the phone, or we can use the Q&A facility on live meeting to submit questions. Either way is fine. And just a quick note, these slides will be distributed to all registered attendees via email after the presentation has concluded. So with that, let me dive into the first section on what was announced and what wasn't. First and foremost, the most significant announcement, it was the center of the keynote on Monday given by Ray Ozzie, was Microsoft's unveiling of its cloud services strategy based on Windows Azure and the Azure Services Platform. It is a very ambitious announcement. This slide shows Microsoft's architecture for Windows Azure and the Azure Services Platform. Now, you'll notice there's really three levels to this framework that Microsoft has put forward. At the bottom layer, you have Windows Azure. And you'll notice Microsoft has used the brand name for Windows and now has extended it to the cloud. So Microsoft has used the Windows brand to talk about Windows Mobile. They've used it, of course, to talk about their desktop and server operating systems. And now they're taking that brand into the cloud for this cloud-based operating system. Now, that's the term they used. It's essentially, the foundation of this model inside of Windows Azure is Windows Server 2008 in a modified version with a modified version of Hyper-V running virtual machines and something layered on top Microsoft calls its fabric controller that handles the provisioning and resource allocation of these virtual machines. It's all under the covers, but that's what's inside of Windows Azure. So those are very low-level system infrastructure services that provide raw compute, storage, and service management services to the applications that run at that level. But you'll notice the next layer up is application infrastructure services, things like live services, or for programmers, the .NET services, or SQL services, or SharePoint and Dynamics CRM services. These are building blocks that a developer would use as they're building a cloud-enabled application on Microsoft's platform. And Microsoft draws a big blue box around that, and they said, this is the Azure Services platform. And so they don't actually use the Windows brand name when they refer to the collective set of services. The Windows brand name is reserved for the lower-level OS-like services, the compute, the storage, and the service management that we talked about. And then on top, Microsoft has their application services, which are designed primarily to be directly consumed by people. Things like Windows Live and Office Live and Exchange Online, and SharePoint Online, and Microsoft's Dynamics CRM Online, some of which actually are pretty close to being shipped today, like Exchange Online. And that's one of our criticisms of the chart is it's a little bit misleading because there are some very real things that Microsoft is doing today, like Exchange Online, that are available for you all to deploy, test, et cetera. And they're pretty darn cost competitive, and they really aren't built on the Azure Services platform, but they are available today. But this is Microsoft's architectural slide. It has three levels, and David's going to talk in more detail about these layers a little bit later in the presentation. There were other announcements made last week as well. The most significant was the cloud platform and the Windows Azure Foundation. But also, Microsoft demonstrated and released the technology preview code for Windows 7. And Mike Silver will talk us through that a little bit later and the implications on your Windows Vista migrations. Microsoft also announced a web-enabled version of Office. We aren't going to talk about this in detail in this particular conference. However, there is analysis of this announcement up on the Gartner website. Mike Silver wrote it. And if you have any questions on this later on when the operator asks for questions, or you could type them into the Q&A chat area, we'd be happy to take those during the Q&A section. The same thing on numbers 4 and 5. Microsoft made some significant announcements related to identity and what they call claims-aware applications. I wrote up an analysis on this particular announcement, and it's on Gartner's website under the name of Neil MacDonald. You could also search on Azure, and you'll find it very quickly. And also Microsoft talked about and released code for their modeling tools. It's codenamed Oslo, but it was a set of three announcements. Microsoft announced a modeling language that they codename M. They announced a modeling repository. And they announced a graphical modeling tool that they've codenamed Quadrant. But all of these are very cool. They're enterprise-focused, but they're tools to link models that you capture in development to models that you deploy in production through things like System Center. And ultimately, and they talked about this on stage, linking these models you develop on premises for enterprise applications to in the cloud services as you move applications back and forth between on premises and in the cloud. So very cool things going on there as well, not the topic of this particular teleconference either, but we're happy to take questions on it. So those were the major announcements. What was missing, though? A couple of things that bothered us, first and foremost, and it should concern you as well, was what's the pricing model for all of this? Whether you're a developer and wondering, well, how much is it going to cost me to put my application in the cloud, or whether you're an enterprise and you're looking at how you might consume these services, there was no pricing model discussed, no pricing specifics except some high-level statements saying that pricing would be consumption-based, and it would be a variable based on the service level that you're requiring. But that opened up another question, which was, well, what are these service levels that are going to be associated with these cloud-based services for you all and for ISVs, and how do you specify them? And how, what if you have services that are hosted somewhere else outside of Microsoft's cloud? So a lot of unanswered questions there. Number three, and this is a very significant issue, we'll talk a little bit in more detail later, but how do you handle legacy applications? Right now, as it stands, Microsoft is telling ISVs, hey, go develop your applications for the cloud. You just can't take an existing application and put it in the cloud. You actually have to do some rewriting of the application and instrument it for Microsoft's Fabric controller. There's work that you have to do. And we all know that it's not as easy as all that to get your ISVs to rewrite their applications or to rewrite all of your .NET applications you may be using. Microsoft really needs a migration path, some way to handle legacy applications. And all they said was, yes, we have a future intention to support native code, but they really gave no details on that. Another question we have is, will this Azure technology be made available to you all so you can purchase and build your own private clouds? If you're a very large organization, you can build data centers and get economies of scale, just like Microsoft. So what if you want to buy the Windows Azure platform and host your own applications and your own equivalent of the Azure services platform? Microsoft provided no details there. Likewise, there are parts of the world where you can imagine they don't want to put their data and their applications in Microsoft's U.S.-based data centers. Microsoft is expanding into Europe, but what about China, for example, or other parts of the world where they want their data and their applications local? Well, we believe Microsoft will open up its Azure platform and allow other people, like telecommunications providers in regional areas, to actually host the Microsoft applications and services on their behalf and become part of this bigger cloud. But there were no details of this provided either. The last one I want to hit here is number six, which is details on security and privacy. When we talk to you all about cloud-based services, this tends to be one of the number one inhibitors. How is my data going to be protected? How is Microsoft going to strongly isolate me from other people in the cloud? Microsoft talks about this, that security and privacy are important, but they really didn't provide details on how they make this happen. Is it, for example, something like Microsoft's rights management service that's integrated into the cloud? Is data automatically encrypted? How is that handled? And no specific details were given, which left quite a big hole. So there's other ones here that you can read through. I'm not going to go through all of them, but the announcement, while visionary, still left quite a bit that was unanswered. Overall, though, it is one of those moments in time where Microsoft appears to be turning the battleship. Microsoft is essentially a lot of little companies under one name and one umbrella, but they operate pretty much independently. And there's a couple points in Microsoft's history where they've all come together and they've responded to a challenge. And the best example is in the 1996 timeframe when the entire company took on the challenge of the Internet. They had a new competitor in the form of Netscape, and Microsoft rallied all of its different product groups and divisions around embracing the Internet and took on Netscape. And we think this is one of those moments when Microsoft internally is rallying the troops across all of the business units and getting them in line to embrace this vision of cloud-based computing. And some of the things that they're doing here are really quite different for Microsoft. Instead of being dependent on the more heavyweight WS Star and SOAP protocols, they've embraced a RESTful programming model. Also, if you're not a .NET developer, Microsoft stood up and said, we are going to deliver integration to languages and tools that are not .NET based. Now, that was a statement they made. No specific tools were released, but they did give at least lip service to supporting things like Python and Ruby and Perl as a way, a programmatic way to access their services in the cloud. The services are also accessible to non-Microsoft platforms. Now, sure, they want you to run Windows Mobile or Windows Desktop or Windows Server to access the services, but even from a Macintosh or Linux, you can run a browser and consume the services. You could run a browser with a Silverlight plugin and consume the services. Or even outside of the browser, outside of Silverlight, there's no reason, no technical reason, a non-Windows platform can't call out and consume these services. So all of these are quite different from Microsoft. It's not your father's Microsoft, the one that is seen to be extremely proprietary. And what we see is a gradual opening up and embrace of open protocols and open standards as Microsoft is architecting its cloud. And that was certainly evident in what they announced with identity, where Microsoft for the first time has supported and will support and announce support for the SAML 2.0 protocol and token format. It's a very specific thing, but it's very important for federated identity, and it's an area where Microsoft and the Liberty Alliance have been going at it for years. And then finally, they stood up and made the public commitment to this, to support SAML 2.0 with their Geneva Token Services Gateway last week at the PDC. So we believe it's a very important point in time for Microsoft, and it does reflect an inflection point. So with that, to go into more detail and an analysis of Microsoft's cloud services, I'm going to turn the presentation over to David.
Thanks, Neil. As you've pointed out here, this is a pretty big deal for Microsoft. There's a lot of announcements and a lot of ways it can be looked at. In fact, for the past 3 years, the company's been talking about a strategy that they've called Software Plus Services. That particular name can be traced back to a response to the trend that was pretty popular for a couple of years called Software as a Service. And it's Microsoft's attempt to show that it's not just software as a service, but something bigger and more. In fact, when we look at where Microsoft is going, we see this as a very ambitious attempt. It's not just software plus services. There are several areas, several dimensions in which Microsoft is trying to bridge gaps. Those range from the enterprise and the consumer world, the development and the management world through modeling and dynamic IT and an extension of their development methodologies, I believe is what that stands for, but I could be wrong, on-premises and off-premises, which is one of the really big things that Microsoft is offering here that their competitors are not. And Microsoft and third parties, including not just Microsoft hosting applications, but also third-party hosters, and multiple business models. The advertising model that we haven't heard a lot of details about, the subscription model, and traditional software licensing models. So Microsoft is really trying to bridge a lot of gaps here, and that's what makes what they're trying to do visionary and, at the same time, pretty ambitious. Now, I'd like to step back for a minute and put it in context to what Gartner calls cloud computing. We have a formal definition, which is that it is a style of computing where we're looking at scalable and elastic IT-enabled capabilities delivered as a service to external customers using internet technology. The cloud, the concept of the cloud has come from, we say, these two very different perspectives, these two different areas from the world of the web, Web 2.0, browsers, software as a service, focus on the services, not having to install software. And at the same time, coming from the world of the enterprise, where there's a lot of focus on data center pressures, cost cost models, capacity planning, what Gartner calls real-time infrastructure and virtualization, grid, service-oriented architecture, and a focus on the enablers of cloud computing, and a focus on not having to buy your own hardware. This also can be looked at in another way, which is on the next slide, from the world of consumers of the cloud, not consumers versus enterprise, but those who are consuming the services and those who are providing the services, typically the vendors. The consumers tend to look at the cloud as this amorphous thing. I'm not going to say magical, but it's out there, and they just assume that someone out there is taking care of it. They don't have to worry about it because things are being delivered as a service. But on the other side, you have the people who are looking to actually deliver it. And they are, of course, having to worry about the specific technologies, the specific costs, how to actually make it work. And as a result, we see that there are these two different points of view, depending upon whether you're a consumer or a provider, depending upon whether you came at it from more of the web view or the data center view. And both of these represent zeitgeist, or centers of gravity. Both are valid viewpoints. Both are valid perspectives on the cloud. And the reason we point this out is because we're going to be talking about things that are being offered at different levels in a taxonomy. And it is important to understand the context in which these terms are being used, because if we have people making statements around things like such and such is cloud computing and such is not cloud computing, that may be true for one perspective, but not necessarily for the other. So a lot of the confusion around cloud can be chalked up to those different perspectives right there. Now, we have devised what we call a taxonomy around the structure of cloud computing. And really, it's the bottom three layers here that we're going to focus on, what we're calling system infrastructure, or the servers and storage, application infrastructure, and the applications services. They're all services. Notice that you can have things plug in at different levels, and we have this stair-step kind of diagram showing that you can interact with the components of a cloud web platform at different levels. And you can do it at the same time. And you can do it in a mix and match sort of way. So you have a sort of a supply chain. You have the ability for this to feed an ecosystem of capabilities that can really span lots of different options and really give a lot of possibilities that haven't existed in the past without this flexible way of looking at things. So this is a very important structure, a very important model that we have developed that we think can help here. Now we're going to start to look at where Microsoft's offerings fit in. And as you can see, even in their diagram, they show three pretty different layers. And while it may not be 100% technically accurate, conceptually, it follows the model, those lower three levels, pretty well. You have Windows Azure, which is the cloud operating system, fits very, very well at that system infrastructure, delivering servers and storage. You have the concept of the services platform, which delivers various levels of functionality, which I'll talk about in a minute, as well as the applications themselves, Office Live, Windows Live, the various online products that are, in Microsoft's terminology, finished services. We call them application services because they can be used directly as applications, and they can also be used in a way that can be programmatically extended. Now, Microsoft's also introduced as part of what they've been talking about here, data center investments in building some of the biggest data centers in the world, as well as the Fabric software that's part of Windows Azure, and is something that is more of an enabler than it is a platform or service because of where it fits into the overall architecture. I want to spend a couple of minutes on the services platform pieces, because there are a lot of different pieces here. There are live services, which can be thought of as the underpinnings of things that expose themselves as applications called Windows Live and Live Mesh. We have .NET services, which could be thought of as extensions to the .NET programming model and existing capabilities like capabilities known as BizTalk services, now being named the .NET Service Bus. SQL services as a SQL Server-based, but not completely SQL Server-accessible set of capabilities for data storage, SharePoint services, and dynamic CRM services underlying the respective applications at a higher level. The dynamic CRM services is worth specifically mentioning. This is something you may have heard of, codenamed Titan, also talked about as XRM. And we think this is a pretty interesting and important one because of all the technologies here that are part of this services platform. It is really the only one that has natively as part of it the support for multi-tenancy at the application level. And we think that is an interesting, if not controversial, area of discussion that people are having in the industry today about how important that is at various levels in the virtual stack here that we're talking about. So those are the various levels of what Microsoft has offered. Now let's talk a little bit about some of the opportunities and the threats. Obviously, we've mentioned these CRM services. We think that is an opportunity. It's in many ways a sleeper. It's something that doesn't get a lot of attention, but we think could ultimately be one of the more important pieces here longer term. We think one of the biggest opportunities is for Microsoft to deliver services that span both the enterprise and the cloud, leveraging hybrid environments, because we believe that most enterprises are going to want some kind of hybrid environment. And the ability for the company to bring cloud technologies to the enterprise as well as enterprise technologies to the cloud, and to protect the investments, not just their investments, but your investments and expertise through tools like Visual Studio and the languages of .NET. But there are threats. One of the biggest threats is fragmentation. When I showed you all those different services at the services platform layer, the live services, .NET, SharePoint, CRM, those are in fact separate platforms. And a lot of what's been done here is to put things on a PowerPoint slide and make them look like they're one thing, but in fact they're not all one thing. There is going to be overlap and confusion that people are going to have. Also, we look at the potential credibility or not via demonstration of the usage of these technologies. One of the things that is true of Microsoft's success over the years is, in fact, their ability to demonstrate the capabilities of their underlying platform technology by using them themselves. Now, as Neil mentioned before, a lot of those applications at the higher level, like the Exchange Online and the like, are not built on these lower level services today. And in fact, as you get into these discussions around multi-tenant application servers and the like, you can get some pretty animated discussions going about whether you even need that. So it's going to be hard for them to demonstrate the credibility, at least today, in this area. And of course, we also have usual kinds of security, privacy, service level agreements. We've already talked a little bit about that, and the fact that at least for Microsoft, it is an unproven business model. So we'll leave with some recommendations. We believe that you should view Windows Azure and the services platform as a technology preview, which they are, and that we shouldn't expect a production-ready release for about another year. .NET developers should be experimenting today, looking at how on-premises apps could be improved with the use of cloud-based services like the .NET Services Bus. But longer term, there's much more to be done. You shouldn't wait to evaluate. In fact, some of these capabilities like Exchange Online and SharePoint Online are going to be available very, very soon, and they are not dependent upon those lower-level services. So while these lower-level services are a technology preview, these offerings are not, and they have the potential for significant cost savings for enterprises today. And you should take a look at some of your existing workloads and look at things like Azure lower-level services and Amazon EC2 and other kinds of things, and talk to Microsoft about supporting existing Windows applications which are not currently supported through hosted virtual machines or through partners. That's something we think is going to be a very interesting area to watch, and flows very well into the next section of what we're going to talk about. I'm going to hand it back to Neil, who's going to talk more about the lower levels here and the impact on enterprise IT organizations.
Okay, thanks, David. So what I want to take some time to talk to you all about is the impact of the Windows Azure platform and the Windows Azure services on enterprise IT. What you have today with Microsoft and what they announced are really two separate things. Along the top, you've got what they announced last week at the PDC. You have essentially Windows Azure, which is a new platform. It's based on Windows Server 2008, and the technologies, the VMs, are based on something like Hyper-V, but it's different. It's not the same release that you all buy in the form of Windows Server 2008. It's not the same thing that they announced in terms of Windows Server 2008 R2, which will be released next year, will co-ship with Windows 7. It's not that. It's something different. And so what you're running in your enterprise is different and divergent than what Microsoft's running in their cloud. However, you want many of these same types of capabilities in your own data center. You would like to treat your IT infrastructure as a service. You would like the ability to dynamically provision workloads and scale up and scale out as needed. Now, you're laying the foundation for this in the form of virtualization and virtual machines. You're taking those first steps by consolidating servers, which later, as you mature that infrastructure, you can start managing towards service levels in a very dynamic fashion. But these things are quite different today, and that's the gap between these two lines that we're showing here. There's what you're doing in your data centers and what Microsoft is talking about with its vision of dynamic IT, and then there's what Microsoft is doing in the cloud. And what Microsoft needs to do is to actually bring these together over time. They said this up on stage. They talked about how they would take the learnings and the technologies from the cloud and bring it into their enterprise offerings, but they provided no specific roadmap. But this is important for you all to understand, because you want to know that the investments you're making in Windows Server 2008 or System Center, that these investments will put you on a path that enables you to more easily migrate to the cloud when and if it makes sense. So this is an area of opportunity for Microsoft to clarify its roadmap and its messaging for you all that continue to make investments in Microsoft's dynamic IT vision. But it does lay down the foundation for Microsoft to really talk about one of its most significant differentiators from competitors in the cloud, competitors like Google, for example, or Amazon with EC2. With these vendors, it's pretty much all or nothing. You do it all in the cloud or nothing. And, of course, the reality is that we have servers, we have applications, we just can't flip a switch and move to the cloud. Therefore, Microsoft has the ability to deliver you all what we call a hybrid model, where you pick and choose which services make sense to put in the cloud. Maybe you'll put email in the cloud. Maybe you'll look at something like SharePoint and put that in the cloud. Won't be all your business applications initially. Certainly you've got security and privacy concerns as well, but you can pick and choose when an application makes sense to migrate to the cloud. But it goes further than that, and that's what this slide talks about. And to make this example real, I'll use Exchange Online to drive the point home. So with Exchange Online, the vision of Microsoft is to allow you to pick and choose where you run Exchange on-premises and where you would run Exchange in the cloud. So, for example, with Gartner, we may choose to run our headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut, in the U.S. We may choose to run our post offices locally, on-premises, in our own data centers. But for all of our hundreds of remote distributed offices around the world, we may say, you know what, I don't want to put all those post offices out there. I'm going to go ahead and put all of my remote office users in the cloud. And so I can have this hybrid model where I've got some of my users on-premises, some in the cloud, and from a management point of view, I can use a single management console to manage both types of users. It's completely transparent to me, the administrator, and it's completely transparent to the user as well. And then you can mix and match these as you see fit. If you want to bring an office into the on-premises data center, great. Drag and drop, move those users and their post offices back on-premises. If you want to take a particular branch and move it out to the cloud, great. As simple as a drag and drop operation. Also, for things like security and identity, a single login between Enterprise Active Directory and in the cloud services. And Microsoft actually announced this last week as a part of their identity-related announcements when they talked about their Geneva Security Token Service, which is an on-premises solution, as well as their Federation Services Gateway in the cloud that will allow you to federate an Active Directory sign-on in the enterprise to a cloud-based Live ID identity that's used in Microsoft's cloud-based services. So, in other words, single sign-on. You can log in into Active Directory in the enterprise and achieve a single sign-on to cloud-based Exchange Online that may be hosted in Microsoft's data center. That's pretty powerful, though, because as you look at other types of applications, whether it's SharePoint or CRM or any of these applications, to have that flexibility of hosting it locally or hosting it in the cloud when and where you see fit to do it. I think that's a great message, and it's certainly quite differentiated from vendors like Google or Amazon where it's an all or nothing decision. But as part of this message, Microsoft has got to do something about legacy applications. You and I live in the real world where we've got lots and lots of existing applications, and it takes a long time for us to rewrite our applications into this new Azure Services Platform framework. It's going to take ISVs years to migrate their applications, and I've got my own .NET applications, and those are going to take years as well if I ever get around to changing the code at all. We need an answer, and a clear answer, from Microsoft on how they're going to handle these older applications. And older can be, you know, your existing .NET applications, but I'm also saying the older applications that predate .NET. It's a C or C++ executable. It's an old Windows application. How can I take advantage of Microsoft's cloud infrastructure and run that in the cloud without having to rewrite it? One way that you can do this, and that Microsoft should consider, would be simply taking that application, virtualizing it, putting it in a virtual machine or a software-based appliance, and running it in the cloud as a pre-configured virtual machine. Seems pretty straightforward. Microsoft, the foundation of Windows Azure, is virtual machines and a hypervisor-like structure based on Hyper-V. Seems like it would be pretty obvious to take that VM container from on-premises and put it in the cloud and therefore achieve backwards compatibility. But Microsoft has not announced that they are going to do this. They've made no specific commitment. All they said was, yes, we know that there's a need to support native code, but didn't provide any details. The bottom of this chart shows the VMs themselves being wrapped in metadata. And that's the orange wrappers. This is really VMware's approach, which says we're going to build a virtual data center OS. We're going to allow you to wrapper your existing applications with operational metadata, and you can host those in our cloud. And this is another reason Microsoft has to clarify what they're going to do, because if they don't support these legacy applications, other vendors will, including Amazon with EC2 and Windows VMs, and, of course, including VMware. So this does have significant implications on you all. How are you going to handle legacy applications? Will Microsoft step up or partner to deliver you a solution to handle legacy applications? Finally, I wanted to talk about the evolution of the cloud computing supply chain. We're fairly early on in cloud computing days, and we have fairly monolithic cloud stacks being introduced. You've got the Google Cloud, and you've got the Amazon Cloud, and now we've got the Microsoft Cloud, and we've got silos of clouds. Now you can expect that supply chains will appear for cloud-based services so that these different cloud infrastructures can call each other. But longer term, we think these silos will actually be torn down. And this may work to Microsoft's advantage over the longer term if it maintains its current course towards interoperability of its cloud-based services. So you could think of Google over the longer term becoming something that's quite proprietary, and Microsoft counterintuitively becoming something that's quite open. It is an opportunity for Microsoft to be seen as a more open cloud computing platform than its competitors. But there are some significant unanswered questions. Who gets to run Azure internally? Right now, only Microsoft gets to run Windows Azure and the Azure Services Platform. But you want to run it, and some of their service providers want to run it as well. We talked extensively about what workloads are supported in Azure. How are you going to handle legacy applications? Do all applications have to be rewritten? Can we containerize them in a virtual machine? Will it be just .NET applications, or what about our older C and C++ native executables as well? Key competitors we can hit during the Q&A section if you have any questions, but there's an overall summary of the key competitors that we see to Microsoft's cloud vision. But I don't want to take away from Mike Silver's time to talk about the adoption of Windows 7 and how this affects your migration or not to Windows Vista.
Thanks, Neil. And to a large extent, we'd actually suggest that Windows 7 really doesn't impact your adoption of Vista all that much. We'll start with a slide that will show you some features, but before I go through that, what I'd like to say is that we think that more important than what features are in a new operating system are really your ability to absorb the new OS and get rid of your older OSs in time. So in a lot of ways, the features don't matter as much as your ability to get rid of Windows XP in time is should you decide to skip Windows Vista entirely, and I'll go over that on the next slide. But just looking at some of the features, ones that are user-centric or really consumer-centric, certainly better home networking. This has been a bane of a lot of folks' existence for a long time, something that I think Apple has really been noted to have done better than Microsoft in terms of making home networking work better. And with Windows 7, Microsoft introduces something called the Home Group. You can connect to your home network when you get home. Your printer automatically switches from your work printer to your home printer, and when you go back to work, it switches back again. So Windows having better awareness of where you are and also allowing you to manage all the media in your home. Device states, being able to work with devices better, see the features and how they connect better than prior versions. Windowing improvements. Microsoft is making a bunch of improvements to allow users that have 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 windows open at once to work better. And along with that, better memory management under Windows Vista and prior, every time you opened up a new window, there was a lot of memory taken. And with Windows 7, Microsoft is looking to improve that so that as you open up new windows, you don't have as many memory issues. Revised sidebar with gadgets that you can really put anywhere. and improvements to user account control. Probably the worst reviewed item in Windows Vista has been user account control, which a lot of enterprises have been looking at in order to try to lock down their desktops, make them more manageable, and reduce total cost of ownership. In Windows 7, the enterprise will still be able to decide what level of user account control is implemented by policy, but for consumers, they'll be able to set their own user account control to make it either more secure and some people would say more annoying, or try to ignore some of the additional prompts. For the enterprise, things like App Locker, the ability to define applications and vendors whose software that users can run or can't run. This has been a big issue for organizations locking down user machines, taking away administrator access, and then when there's a new version of something like Live Meeting, a standard user can't install it and sometimes can't get into the meeting. So AppLocker is designed to help those issues. BitLocker to Go, which is full volume encryption for USB.
Hello.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Well, we lost Mike Silver. David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, all right. So let me continue on. Mike was talking through the Windows 7 features. The VPNless access is a technology based on IPv6. It's called Direct Access. It's interesting, but it does require network reconfiguration. But I think as you look across this list, the question that you all are asking is, well, how does this impact my migration? So here's the talking discussion points on the risk of skipping Windows Vista. Here you'll see the ISV support line for Windows XP. Actually, the support for Windows XP in green from Microsoft, the mainstream support phase, and then the extended support phase in kind of the brown color, and finally ending in June of 2014 with Microsoft's 5+5 support plan. So many of you think, well, gee, since Microsoft's not going to drop support until 2014, maybe I can just skip Vista. Our concern is the issue is not that Microsoft support ends, but we're more worried about ISV support for Windows XP starting to wane, meaning it becomes harder to find ISVs that support Windows XP, especially once Windows 7 ships. Because once Windows 7 ships, essentially an ISV then has to make the decision, well, do I support Windows 7 and Windows Vista and XP? If I'm going to drop one of those, which one am I going to drop? And that's why we think as Windows 7 ships, it actually legitimizes Windows Vista, since applications that are written for Vista should run with no changes on Windows 7. Microsoft is striving for a high degree of compatibility. So the ISV support for Windows XP starts to become an issue starting in 2010. And then in the brown circle, it really starts to be a significant issue towards the 2011-2012 timeframe, where it becomes really hard for you to actually get support on some of these older applications. So we're really, if you plan to skip Vista, you are planning on Microsoft shipping nearly on time. There is always the possibility that Microsoft could be late or delay shipments, and that really puts you between a rock and a hard place, where certainly if you're migrating by attrition, you start to run out of time, because the earliest most people will actually start deploying Windows 7 will be about a year after it ships. It's going to ship. You're going to want to test it. Some of you will wait for Service Pack 1, and most of you won't actually start deploying until late 2010, early 2011, and if you're doing this through attrition and migrating 25% of your machines at a time, you'll see you run out of time. The ISV support becomes a serious issue, and eventually you run out of support by Microsoft before you can complete your migration. And that's why our advice is, for now, if you're looking at Vista, go ahead and deploy it on new machines. Bring in Vista through attrition. A lot of the testing that you're going to do to make sure that Windows Vista works will support you as you look forward to Windows 7, since Microsoft has strived to maintain a high degree of compatibility between the applications. So we'll bring Mike back on for the Q&A section. But let me go ahead and provide you these overall observations from the presentation today. We also have another full page of recommendations. But rather than read all these individually, we will be emailing out the handout from this presentation later to all registered attendees. But I want to leave the last 10 minutes for Q&A. And I see that many of you have already started typing in questions using the chat capability. That's great. We'll start hitting those, and we'll ask the operator to also solicit questions live as well. So one of the questions that has come in was specific to my statement around claims-aware applications. So what are claims-aware applications? First of all, I'll direct you to the Gartner research. I put up a first take. If you search on the code name Geneva or you search on Azure, you'll see the research that I published around this notion of claims-aware applications. And in that research, it links to other research last year where I interviewed Kim Cameron. He's Gartner, Microsoft's identity architect. I did this as part of Gartner's fellow project. Anyways, to net it out, a claims-aware application is an application that externalizes its authentication to outside sources. You don't hard code the entitlement information in the application. You manage it externally in some type of a claims-based infrastructure. And you use things like a federation and a security token service to make sure you have the authentication credentials that you need. And it allows you to change authentication policy very easily without having to go back and change applications. It's a great vision. Whether or not you buy into Microsoft and the cloud and .NET, doesn't matter. Multiple vendors are moving down this path to externalize entitlement information out of applications. So we can certainly direct you to more research, or I'd be happy to have a follow-on call to go into more detail. But it is a movement in the industry to get hard-coded entitlement information out of applications. David, there was another question here that said, where would code changes be required if somebody is an existing .NET developer?
Well, I think the answer to that would depend on what you're trying to do. If all you're trying to do is move an existing .NET app to run in the cloud as is, the changes would be fairly minimal. It'd be pretty similar to the kinds of changes that you have to do when trying to move an existing Linux app to Amazon EC2, for example. However, if what you're trying to do is take advantage of some of the new features and capabilities, such as the .NET Service Bus, then obviously you're going to want to take advantage of those and write to those. In addition to that, if you are looking to be able to take advantage of the capabilities provided by Windows Azure and the fabric underneath, the so-called enlightened applications that can be managed by that fabric, then there is going to be a small amount of learning of some additional APIs that need to be implemented. That's, I would say, fairly small if that's all you're trying to do. But then again, if you're trying to build a full-fledged, high-scale, multi-tenant app, then you're looking at some significant work that would be beyond what we're talking about here.
Right. We talked to some application developers at the PDC that had ported their applications to work And so as David pointed out, if you're an existing .NET developer and you're used to Visual Studio, it's actually pretty easy. And they estimated less than a week's worth of effort on their development team. There is work that has to be done. You have to instrument the application to talk to the Fabric controller so the Fabric controller can then provision the application to scale up or scale out as needed. So there are changes that are necessary, but they're not significant if all you're doing is trying to take an existing application and get it to run up in the cloud. Longer term, though, building a cloud-native application, you know, redesigning an application from the ground up, knowing that you have these cloud-based resources would take longer, and it would really take advantage of a change in mindset to make the developer think differently of how they might do things if they had these cloud services at their disposal. But it's minimal effort, but you can't just take an existing .NET application and run it unmodified, not in what Microsoft has currently provided. So, David, here's one. You mentioned the dynamic CRM services. And the question that has come in over the chat is Microsoft going to try to court ISVs to build on their cloud platform to compete with Salesforce and similar application-level platforms?
Well, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is, again, it's going to vary by which sets of services you're talking about. I believe that if you're talking about competing directly with Force.com, the underlying structure for Salesforce.com, the piece that would be most applicable would in fact be the dynamic CRM services or Titan. At this point, we haven't seen a big effort on the part of the company to push that, but I think we will. And we will also see mostly, I'm not going to say completely independent efforts, but more focused efforts on the other various sets of services. For example, Live, which is targeted more at consumer apps and probably advertising-based business models and the like, and the .NET pieces, which will be targeted more at least some of those pieces at enterprise kinds of applications. So I think we will see a lot of efforts there, and Microsoft has over the years had a pretty good track record with doing platform level activities.
Yeah, if we go back to a picture that we showed earlier in the presentation, remember the stair-step diagram that David showed. It essentially, the reason we did the stair-step diagram, and Microsoft didn't do it in their chart, but we did it. The reason we showed that stair-step diagram was to reinforce the point that at any of those levels, those services can be exposed and consumed programmatically or potentially even directly by an end user. And so in this case, at the up at the application level services level, Microsoft is exposing these CRM Live services, what was formerly codenamed Titan, and allowing people to build in a Force.com-like fashion extensions to their CRM applications. But as David has pointed out, they really downplayed this. There are capabilities here that go far beyond CRM into general relationship management capabilities that Microsoft has that they really did not talk about last week at the PDC. So here's another interesting question, David. It says, look, if we're all moving to cloud-based infrastructure using internet-based standards, then do you really need an operating system at all?
Well, an operating system where is the question. I mean, is the question around a cloud OS, which Microsoft is talking about here with Windows Azure? Is the question, do we need a desktop OS like Windows 7, because presumably everything is going to be accessed through a browser? I think the answer is yes in both cases. We are still going to need both because these things do, in fact, need coordination. And what an operating system does is coordinates things and runs things underneath all the way down to the metal. And in the case of the cloud, that's what the Fabric and Windows Server do. They run things. And on the desktop, you're still going to need to run things as well because not all applications are going to be in the pure cloud. there are going to be hybrid situations, and there are going to be examples of applications, especially from Microsoft and ones that they are going to evangelize, that will take advantage of desktop power as well as cloud power.
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of talk for years, really, about the desktop OS becoming really unimportant. I don't buy it, at least for now, because even if a lot of applications come around that are OS agnostic, the installed base of applications that most organizations have, it still includes about 70 to 80% Windows applications. So even if we kept moving to OS agnostic applications, it's really a long time before the OS is totally unimportant, and it's something that you still have to worry about, at least for now. But certainly as we get more agnostic, it will become a bit easier to have more choice there.
Well, with that, we're out of time. Thank you all for joining us today to talk about the Microsoft PDC announcements. Again, the presentation will be emailed out to everyone that registered. If you search on the Gartner site, search on the word Azure, you'll find the majority of the analysis that's been written, and it also links to other analysis. But Mike Silver, for example, has put up his analysis of Windows 7. Mike Silver joined Matt Cain. They put up their analysis of the web-enabled Office applications that Microsoft announced. You'll see my analysis of the Claims Aware announcement, the Geneva technology, as well as the Federation Services Gateway. David Smith and I have an event note that will be published. It should be later today or tomorrow. And Yefim Nadas, one of our application infrastructure analysts, has an analysis going up of the application infrastructure services themselves. And, of course, for those of you that are the Gartner clients, feel free to reach out and engage us one-on-one using the inquiry process as well. So with that, thank you, David, and thank you, Mike, for joining us, and thank you all for attending.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.